lovely to see you in the Beit HaMidrash. I got a few requests from folks who are either traveling or will join us later, and we'll nod and welcome them too as they find their spots. But for now, just since we're a mix of newer faces and old-timers, as they say, I'll just go around quickly and let everybody say their names. And so can I start with you over the side? I don't like to look in one direction, but I have to start somewhere.
I am Fred Stein.
Judy
Sykes.
Marianne
Hyman.
Bill
Hyman.
Ron
Eisenblum.
Richard Eunice.
Harry Hughes.
Charlie Spielholz.
Jay Palmer.
Carol Rentner.
Very good. Very good. Meira sends greetings from, she went off and is traveling. Barry and Bobby said they'll come join us soon, and we'll see.
To say Meira's traveling, you really have to be more specific.
That's true. That's true. She's our resident astrologer, so. All right, so this is a Yoma. This is a fantastic chapter of Masechet Yoma. Tractate Yoma, the day, called probably one of the most ancient temple-oriented Masechtot, the most temple-oriented tractates of the Talmud, because most of it is about what happened in the temple. And that makes it a great kind of antique of sorts for the rabbis even. They want to preserve this antique and relevant still temple culture in many, many ways. One of them is to have an entire Masechta about Yom Kippur really presented to us in seven chapters before the eighth. I don't think there is a single element of Talmud that doesn't have some meaning. And when they, in this breakdown, the Babylonian Talmud that we use, this is a Babylonian Talmud, and as folks know, we'll go back through some details of the Talmud itself and structures and forms of hermeneutics and argumentation, and there'll be reviews for those who know them already and introductions for those who don't yet have all of the vocabulary, and we'll make sure we get there and come after class and we can talk about structures of hermeneutics if it interests you. But I don't think there's a single element that is not without meaning and purpose. And we have seven chapters of the day of Yom Kippur in the Beit HaMikdash, and the eighth chapter, the one beyond the foundational creation seven chapters, is the chapter that deals with Yom Kippur right up to our time. Yom Kippur of our time. Yom Kippur of the rabbinic era. If we're still in an ice age, geological, we're in the rabbinic era as Jews still, capital R. And the rabbis and the rabbinic way of thinking about life is really the period in which we still exist. That means chapter 8 is a unique chapter that is going to be about all we do on Yom Kippur and all of what Yom Kippur holds by way of concept and philosophy. And we read, for the simple sense of the text, we read also here in terms of the rabbinic building of the text, we read in a certain sense literarily in that way, but what we're looking for is narrative, even where there is not necessarily complete narrative. What comes before, what comes after, all very meaningful by way of the build-up of this text that is, let's say, the Babylonian Talmud is put to sleep 8th century CE in Babel, Sasanian Persia, from a diaspora community of Jewish scholars and sages who have created the know-how, the documentation, the greatest law code, the sometimes codific, apodictic law code, sometimes conversational and discursive conversation about Jewish thought, law, practice, and what life is all about. And they've presented it to us in this way, those editors. We read it for all that. We read it in light of the fact that their project, the Mishnahs particularly, those core elemental texts of the Talmud being the Mishnayot, individual Mishnahs of the entire Mishnah, which itself is 63 tractates. The Babylonian Talmud, does not appear as a Talmudic project on all of those tractates, by the way. Many in the first couple of tractates of Mishnah don't get their own Talmud, but most do in the six orders of Mishnah, and most have them. And we read in light of their project of what's on our pages, what's in our books, we realize that manuscripts were the way these texts were circulated around, and we also realize that there was a Talmud that preceded this one, which was dedicated to members of this class, the green Talmud that I didn't ask you to purchase. But we'll also take a look this time around at Talmud Yerushalmi. We'll compare what's in the Jerusalem Talmud to what's in our Talmud and ask why the editors went one way or another, especially if they had this Talmud to really work with, because this is put to bed pretty much by the 4th century, this Jerusalem Talmud. So we'll also work in terms of looking at the Torah verses that the Mishnah brings to bear and is working through when it comes to creating law in a more codified format. And we'll ask whether or not the laws in the Mishnah have worked themselves directly from a Torah passage sometimes, making them of Torah status, right? We call that de'araita. There's a status assigned to Torah laws. It's a rabbinic structure. It's a rabbinic category. Certain mitzvot and certain elements of mitzvot get a de'araita structure, a direct from the Torah kind of status assignment. And there are others that are derabbanan, rabbinic mitzvot, rabbinic because they are given that status, because the rabbis derive them. And even if it would seem to us that it's saying it as directly as a mitzvah of a raita status, a Torah status, then sometimes we're going to see it as a derabbanan status. It's a rabbinic status. And other times the rabbinic status is not the mitzvot. They won't be as noticeable in a straight line to the words of the Torah or Tanakh. And that's why they're called derabbanan. And the rabbis, though, are giving us this whole kind of life's goal. This is your destiny, Jewish people, they're saying through the Mishnah and the Gemara. Your destiny is to inherit the tradition as we understand it, post the temple's destruction, realization that there is diaspora and Israeli Jewish community, Palestinian Jewish community, and that we want to have meaningful relationships with Torah, fulfilling it, because it's God's word, and steer clear of the sin that is part of it. Obviously, Yom HaKippurim, is the day that God is going to wipe the slate clean for us. And we have to get to a practice on our own, because we're all not going to the temple for Yom HaKippurim. We're not even going to the temple for Yom HaKippurim when Yom Kippur was being worked out in truth at the temple. It wasn't a pilgrimage festival, per se. So what you get in those 7 chapters is the description of everything that you could trust is going on in the temple, and you're to be completely connected to this temple culture, which will make its way into the liturgy of Yom Kippur Day because of its power as ritual, symbolic power, and penitential power, that it can atone for sins, and we live with a live kind of sense of sin and what sin is. And a little of that will come out later in pages to come. What's the nature of sin? But not right off the bat. Right off the bat, we're going to be told how to practice our Judaism on Yom HaKippurim, on Yom Kippur. So if you'll open up to page 73, and these work out, a Talmudic page is a side A and a side B of a number. So we're on page 73b4. There's no running page count. There's no running page count on here, so you have to find 73b4. There you go. It should have chapter 8 up at the top and a Mishnah, right? 73b4, we're going to jump into this Mishnah, but we're going to jump into this Mishnah only after we do some introductory Torah study, because we need the background. So I'm going to circulate what has come from the Yerushalmi volume that's sitting in front of me, the green volume that gives a little introduction to the chapter. Take one of those, pass it around. All right, we're interested in Yom Kippur's roots in the Torah. Need another? I've got plenty, so.
Thank you.
Okay. So, as this says, we've discussed the Yom Kippur temple service at length. The tractate turns to the laws of Yom Kippur, chapter 8 in the Yerushalmi as well. It's not all the time exactly lined up, so again, interesting to note that it's 8. There are two Yom Kippur obligations that apply outside the temple. Refrain from work, because it's called a Shabbat Shabbaton in the Torah. And two, one must afflict oneself by fasting and by abstaining from the other pleasures the Mishnah lists. The prohibition to work on Yom Kippur is virtually the same as the prohibition to work as on the Sabbath, and hence the laws regarding work on Yom Kippur are those discussed in Tractate Shabbat, and Tractate Yoma focuses on the laws of affliction. So what we're going to think about are the afflictions. You know, I thought much more interesting to focus on the afflictions than the Sabbath-like malachot works that appear in Tractate Shabbat. Because these are, I think, what most people associate with Yom Kippur, right? If I said to you, what do we do on Yom Kippur? What do you quickly say?
Fast.
You fast. What else?
Don't have sex.
What you do or what you're not supposed to do.
Don't wash.
Don't brush your feet.
Don't wear leather shoes.
Wear white.
Okay, thou shalt do. Thou shalt wear white,
don't
right?
Wear blood, not anoint yourself.
Don't anoint yourself, meaning no oils and no scents. Okay, we pretty much got it covered. But let's see what the Torah says. Does the Torah say anything specific? If we always want to, with the Mishnah study and then into Talmud, ask ourselves, would we know what to do if we only knew the Torah?
No.
So, v'ayul tatafot bein einecha. They were like signs between your eyes. Would you know that that meant a small black box that's called tefillin? You wouldn't know that. And so when people say, you're not a Torah Jew, you say, you're right. I'm a rabbinic Jew. This whole argument in the world about Torah Judaism is a misguided way of understanding Torah. Rabbinic Judaism and rabbinic culture is what creates the what we know and how to do Judaism. And let's look at the passages now and see exactly what we would do or would say. Sometimes people who have been here before know. I want you to think about yourselves right now as if you were on the editorial council of the Mishnah. What could you possibly, without now retrojecting what we do know, we do already. Thankfully, as a community, we do this, we engage it. But what would you say if this was the only source you had and you were developing with the council of Chachamim, of sages, at Yavne, year, circa 200, you were developing the Mishnah. So let's look. Leviticus 16:29-31 is the first place where we have some instruction about the Day of Atonement. It will be for you chukat olam, a law forevermore, an eternal decree, in the seventh month. Why do we call Tishrei the seventh month? Because in the Torah, Nisan is number one, right? Nisan and the going out of Egypt, that's the first month in the Torah. Be'asor l'chodesh, on the tenth of the month, ta'anu et nafshoteichem. You shall ta'anu, whatever, that verb, afflict yourselves, is what we usually say in English. Ta'anu et nafshoteichem. You know, if you have a certain, by the way, expertise in different areas that I don't know about yet that you can bring to the class, you know, that's what we ask people here, to make a little commentary about from their realm of the world. Some people have more Ivrit than others. We sometimes stop to talk about Ivrit. Ron, I'm just interested on Israeli ears, language ears. What would you say for a translation of Ta'anu if someone just said to you, Ta'anu?
Make yourself suffer.
Make yourself suffer.
Torture.
Almost torture, right? So if you just hear the verb, it could be a little bit more of a valence of suffering, is the point, than just like a little affliction. It has that within it. And affliction in English seems to be one way of getting around the fact that it may not be exactly torture yourself.
No, suffering is not torture.
Right. So, and it may not even be suffer. So keep that in mind as we're trying to really tease out the meaning of this word. All right. On the 10th of the month, you have to ta'anu your nafshoteichem. How would we translate nafshoteichem for those who know a little Hebrew?
Soul.
Nefesh. Your soul. Anybody else have a different translation? Now, biblically, if you came up with the suggestion soul, your souls, at this point, well, there is, and I might ask you, were you hanging out at the philosopher's house down the road? Because the philosopher's house, and by the way, they have called what's called Beit Philosoph. That's actually, I'm not being tongue-in-cheek. We saw it in chapter 16 of Shabbat, where they were worried that people were going to hang out by the Beit Philosoph. Philosoph on a Shabbat afternoon. That's one of the reasons maybe why we have a drush and mincha on Shabbat afternoon. Philosophy is alive at the time. Philosophers are more into the concept of soul at this time. Maybe because it's the rabbinic era, you're beginning to have dualists in the rabbinic population. But for the most part, we're not so accepting of the Phaedo. We're not so accepting of Plato's concept at this point. We're not, that's not bought, that's not hook, line, and sinker sold to the Jews. So we might say soul, and we might just simply accept the translation at this point in Jewish history. But we have to keep ourselves very much cognizant of the fact that that's being worked out.
Has a connotation of spirit.
It could be spirit, but again,
spirit not in that. I don't mean like ghost spirit. I mean like your
own kind
your
of
spirit. Yeah.
And again, there's also a very, we would have to read through some of the brachot, Masechet Brachot, and other places in Shabbat. Like you do have a sense that there's spirituality and a developing idea of what spirituality is, but not like a term like ruchaniyut. Not like a spirituality that we have come to understand after 13th, 14th century and the Hasidic, pietistic Hasidic movement of early Ashkenaz, not after 15th century, 16th century mystical texts. Nothing of the sort like that. So, it's just a suggestion that it could mean simply for some, afflict your bodies. When the nefesh is described as getting the breath of life in it, in Genesis, we are to understand that it is a lump of clay shaped and formed and molded, and God created the human being as a nefesh chaya, as a living, breathing body. So there would have been some around who simply see it as that. Afflict your body. pshat. And that's kind of what we're doing with all of what's going to be in this first Mishnah. How it impacts our soul, we've come to make our own drush. Each of us comes with our own quote-unquote drush, our own meaning-making on these. But in this time, we have to ask whether or not we see any evidence, and it will be an open question. Do we see any evidence in the chapter that we're talking about the soul level, the spirituality level? These are good questions to put on the table when we launch this study, as we launch this study. Okay, let's keep going. V'chol melacha lo tasu. All the manner of work in your precinct you shouldn't do. In other words, that word malacha is the clue to Olav Shabbat malachot. Malacha is a category of work, not just one little work. There are 39 essential categories of that work on a Sabbath, and we make all kinds of expansions on those to get detailed about what thou shalt do, what thou shalt not do. And therefore we have this day to refrain from all that. Ha'ezrach v'hager hagar b'tochachem. So who's actually supposed to be involved in Yom Kippur? The Ezrach is for sure a citizen, a full-fledged citizen, whatever that word means in biblical parlance. And the ger, hagar b'tochachem, and whatever that word means in biblical parlance. And we've talked a little bit about it in class, because we had a chapter of Talmud about making sure we had the right walls and protections around our cities, and who you're really protecting and who you're not really protecting, and the ger was included. And this could be someone who is at the outside rung, not yet a Jew, lives within the community, is to, in a certain sense, take on Jewish obligations. The person is not an evid, not a slave, not an indentured servant type, and at the very closest, if you will, it could mean the one who is a sojourner with you, who lives entirely Jewishly, and we don't yet have the category of quote unquote who's a Jew. We just have the gerim. We have quote-unquote converts without having conversion ceremonies in the biblical age. But we have those sojourners. We have the mixed multitude who came out of Egypt with us. We have people who hang on. They're part of who we are. And certain days, they're mentioned as needing to participate in our rituals.
So do they live as Jews, do we think?
Well, at least on Yom Kippur, it seems like they're included in what they've got to do.
They're on for
Pesach
the affliction
part. They're on for the affliction part, that's right.
They signed up for the affliction.
Well, you know, and that's maybe why in the Gemara, for one of the two great sugyas about conversion, it says, do you really want to adopt all the suffering and connect with all of the, you know, that's suffering fun. Of Israel? That's funny. Okay. Verse Lamed, 30. Ki vayom hazeh, on that day, what are you going to do, or what's going to happen? Yechaper lechem, litaher etchem, mikol chatotechem lifnei Hashem titharu. On that day, you will be provided atonement. Yechaper lechem, God will He will make atonement for you. It's either God will, or it's the Kohen Gadol. Yechaper lechem, litaher etchem, going to purify you, mikol chatotechem, from all your sins, lifnei Hashem titharu, before God, you will become cleansed or purified. Shabbat Shabbaton hi lachem, it's a complete Shabbat, Shabbat Shabbaton, which is why Yom Kippur can fall on a Sabbath, and why we can fast on a Yom Kippur that falls on a Sabbath, because we don't fast otherwise, we delay fasts that fall on the Sabbath. Ve'initem et nafshotechem, and you shall afflict yourselves, chukat olam. It's an eternal decree. So how many times have we seen the verb initem, or la'anot? We've seen it twice in these verses, right? first time we stopped, it says Ta'anu et nashotechem, that's one. And over here in verse 30 is another one, v'initem, two forms of the verb.
And what exactly does the verb
mean? Well, we said afflict. Quickly, we took a quick poll about what the root conveys. Is there suffering in it? Is there torture in it? Afflict we use because in English it's less than either of those. And we're unsure if afflict completely explains what we're to do on these days. I'm holding open the possibility that we need to do a little bit better of a translation than just afflict.
When it says Afkat Olam.
Yeah, an eternal decree.
It means eternal in terms of time, or does it mean a worldwide decree?
Oh, it means eternal in terms of time. Yeah.
Any other eternal decrees that are listed that way?
That's a good question. Yeah, I mean, accepting this, for instance, we say accepting this mitzvah as a word that covers all of Torah is a chukat olam.
It's a phrase that's used.
And there are several other mitzvot that are more specific in which it's used. Leviticus 23 now. So that was 16. Vayedaber Hashem Moshe le'emor. God says to Moses, saying, Ach. There's this word Ach. We discussed it on Sukkot. Does it limit? Does it say, make it the most of? Be'asor lachodesh hashvi'i, on the 10th of the 7th month, hazeh, yom ha-kippurim hu. It will be a day of Kippurim. Mikra kodesh yihyeh lechem. There shall be holy convocation. Ve'initem et nashotechem, number 3. Vehikravtem ishel Adonai, and you should also have an offering to God. Vechom lachalo ta'asu be'etzem hayom hazeh, and don't do any manner of work, as it's a yontif. Ki yom ha-kippurim hu lichaper lechem lifnei Hashem lohechem, because it's the day that you'll have atonement before God. Ki chol ha-nefesh asher t'une be'etzem hayom hazeh, because all people, bodies, say souls, with who will t'une, who will be afflicted. It's a hufal form of the verb. It's a passive form of the verb that will come into play later as being very meaningful. Grammar and its forms will come into play in the hermeneutics of the Talmud time and again. Ki chol ha-nefesh asher t'une be'etzem
lo t'une
be'etzem hayom hazeh v'nichrata me'ameha. If you're not afflicting your bodies, if you're not afflicting your souls, you shall get karet. You shall be cut off from your people. That's the most severe, even with a death penalty. Karet is most severe. Cut off. Entirely cut off. Physically, spiritually. V'chol ha-nefesh asher ta'aseh kol melacha ba'etzem hayom hazeh. And any soul, anybody does any work on this day, I'll make sure that I'll destroy that soul and the connection to its people. Turn over. Shall do no manner of work. Don't do anything. It's an eternal decree for your generations to come in all of your residential places. Shabbat Shabbaton hu lachem. It is a Shabbat Shabbaton. Ve'initem et nashotechem. And how many times is that?
Four.
Or if I count to une, where am I?
Five.
Lachodesh be'erev me'erev ad erev tishbetu shabbatachem. From evening to evening, on the ninth of the month, and that evening, from evening to evening, you shall rest on that day. Now, what is that last part, by the way? On the ninth of the month, what happens? That's true. Keep that in mind. All right? Keep that in mind. That's not in our Mishnah, and it's not in our Gemara. this is verse Lamed Bet.
Lamed Aleph.
Shabbat Shabbaton hu lechem ve'initim en ashoteichem. And hold on one second, I want to read you one thing. Okay, it's a day of complete rest for you. You shall afflict yourselves on the ninth of the month in the evening. From evening to evening shall you rest on your rest day. So, what is this Mikra Kodesh according to Rashi? Listen. Kadshehu, you shall sanctify it. Bichsut nikiya, with clean clothing. What color do you think that clean clothing is? White? So, that, you're with Rashi. Uva tefillah, and its own prayer. V'yom HaKippurim. Uvishar yamin tovim, and on other festivals besides that of Yom Kippur, b'ma'achal, with food. Uva mishteh, and with drink. Uva chasut nikiyah, and with clean clothing. Uva tefillah, and prayers. He wants to make sure you know that there's no room here for thinking that maybe because of the mentions of Shabbat Shabbaton and however many times it kind of sounds like regular Yontif, lo taseh kol melacha, you might say, oh, wait a minute, maybe it sounds like we need to make meals on this day, especially if it falls on the Sabbath. Because Shabbat Shabbaton, because inherently I think that Shabbat requires meals, but I could still afflict myself otherwise. Editorial board, we're not going there. We're not going there. But Midrash only comes to say that when perhaps there were some people thinking about it. Rashi in Troyes in France, remember he's part of the diaspora community, we're talking 11th century now, he has a vested interest in telling you, in shorter form, the Midrash explains to you that even though you might be thinking about Jewish law developing and the rabbinic project of the law developing, just make sure you understand what they mean here by telling you Shabbat Shabbaton and Kol Melachah Lo Taseh, and you're going to compare it, maybe, wait, the language sounds so close to what we do for Yontif. No. Shtiyah Achila, eating and drinking on other days is fine. But not on this day. He's holding true to what is at the beginning of our Mishnah, which sets out the traditions for Yom Kippur based on our verses. Again, Numbers, last verse. What's the last time we have holy convocation and we're told to make this convocation? V'asor l'chodesh ha-shvi'i hazeh mikra kodesh yiyeh lechem. It shall be a holy convocation for you. So, again, prayer and coming together. Ve'initem et nafshoteichem, and you shall afflict your souls. Kol melacha lo tasu, and all the work, like on Yontif, don't do. So what's different is ve'initem et nafshoteichem. As an editorial board, we're writing the Mishnah. Okay? What do I know about the word ve'initem, or ta'anu, from these passages? What may I say is the Torah's sense of defining la'anot et nashotechem? Frankly, unless somebody has a conception that really they've come up with something based on the language here, there's a repetition of the phrase, but I'm not sure we have any understanding of what we really mean.
If on Yom Tov we need to have happiness and we can eat and have a festivity, maybe here, because it's Shabbat Shabbaton, is the exact opposite of what we are doing on Yom Tov.
Good. So maybe from that verse, Shabbat Shabbaton, Maybe it's a Shabbaton from Shabbat, in a certain sense like a Shvut from Shabbat. It's sitting, resting, not doing exactly what we do on other Shabbatot. I like that direction. I don't know that anybody else had that midrashic of a direction, but we call that midrashic and not a midrash because it's not from the genre. But that's midrashic thinking. If I take a phrase and I see within the phrase a repetition and glean repetition, glean meaning from the repetition, well, perhaps that's an interesting take. Right? We're inheritors of midrashic readings of our psukim, of our verses, and so we can make that. That's a nice read. They've read it as Shabbat Shabbaton is a little bit extra of elements on the Shabbat that allows you to do what we're going to consider by the Mishnah to be the Inuye Nefesh. Okay.
Are there those, since we don't know the entire development yet, are there those who see in that Sharush Oni and just see deprivation as opposed to a more active kind of attempt to inflict discomfort?
Yeah, so the history exactly of the ritual we're going to leave aside for right now, but the root itself, if you take a look at the most expansive Hebrew dictionary we have now, it's I think in 7 or 8 volumes, our major work that expanded on what we call as the basic biblical dictionary of Brownsburg Driver, BDB. There's now like a 7-volume ancient Hebrew roots and uses kind of dictionary.
I'm glad I went to school when I did. It was just one.
No, this different project really expanded it. So I was just learning in it today to think about the root. And there's an entry that says that it is to hold back on pleasures and to humble oneself. So that if I had that sense from a few places in the Bible, and I didn't bring all those verses to learn together, but I could potentially have that meaning and be wondering at the editorial council whether or not the choices I'm going to make vis-a-vis the ritual are really humbling oneself. By the way, my contention is, for those who have not heard this, is that part of what the Chachamim were doing at Yavne in 200, remember, that's where they get after the destruction of the temple. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai requests Yavne and the sages, and that then there's a movement around of the sages in the land of Israel, and the Mishnah becomes the written project edited by Yehuda Hanasi in the year 200. Sages from different areas of the world already at that point, some in Babel, in Babylon, in many different parts of Israel, all, in my estimation, came together, and they said, well, here we practice like this, and no, here in our area we practice like that, and minority opinions are recorded, and this is the great Chiddush of the Mishnah, that we have majority opinions and minority opinions, tertiary opinions, fantastic corpus of law then, and we also gain the insight that most likely there were various sages whose opinions did not make it onto the pages, whose practices, if you take a look at Torah, and thank God we're able to be a little creative ourselves, perhaps there's a fourth or fifth practice. Maybe it was alive by one person at the editorial board, but they just said, not really. And they rejected it. Some of those, by the way, make it into what we know is the Tosefta, which is a parallel document to the Mishnah. It's a Tanaitic text. The Mishnah, we call the sages of the Mishnah the Tanaim, right? So the Tanaim of the Mishnah, there's also a Tanaitic text called the Tosefta. The age of Tanaim also produces some of the halachic midrash interpretations of the Torah. And so we can sometimes go to them as well and see what were they thinking. Yerushalmi records some different opinions. Parallels sometimes too. Meanwhile, that all takes us to, or back to, the notion that could be about humbling yourself. Could be that you do something really outside and different because of Shabbat Shabbaton. Let's talk further about the nature of this expression. So I want you to see one place We're not going to read the whole psalm, but I want you to see from inside the canon how internal midrash sometimes works inside the Tanakh. So before I'm even in the Gemara with you, what we've done is we've explored the verses in Torah, and there's kind of a Talmudic project going on inside the Tanakh itself. Because sometimes I'll get an expression that was used over here that didn't exactly have a detail, that is used over here that has another detail, and from the fact that I get this detail over here, I can learn potentially what it means to tell me over here, back here, right? So that's what I'm going to show you now, internal to the Tanakh. That's called intertextuality to some of the biblical scholars. It's called the beginnings of Gemara to some others, if you're a Talmudist and you're into Talmudics. All right, so I want to show you a verse in Tehillim, in Psalms, chapter 35. So I want to show you, just look at verse 35. I'm sorry, this is Psalm 35. Look at verse 13. Okay? This context. So this guy is really, really sick for, he's done, you know, wants there to be unrighteous witnesses rise up. They ask me of things that I know not. They repay me evil for good. Bereavement has come to my soul. Right? I'm doing right here, God. Verse 13. Vani, and as for me, Bachalotam levushi sak, when they were sick, my clothing was sackcloth. Eneti vatsom nafshi, afflicted my soul with fasting. Utfilati al cheki tashuv, and my prayer, may it return into my own bosom. And what do you notice about the prayer line there? There's tshuva in it. There's repentance. There's return. And what do you notice about eneti, our root? Vatsom nafshi. Ah, so in between the words, the root, ayin nun hey, shel inui, and nafshi, the word that means either body or soul, what word do I now find?
Tsom.
And from the fact that I see it here, I now have the beginnings of halachic development of practices that define the term when it was used five or six times back in Leviticus and Numbers for Yom Kippur. Yeah? So sometimes that's how things develop. The relationship I see with the very words, the essential phrases that create the halachic rubrics that I want to have in practice for a day, are now explained how to do that. Yes, sometimes it's completely by the Mishnah, because I go directly from the Torah to Mishnah sometimes, but I don't want to forget that it was here also in the Psalms already that they said a fast goes along with this expression of afflicting the soul, afflicting the body. All right? And that's just one place.
The capital letter N that we have over here, that's for what?
Where is that?
You have several capital N's in
this. This was taken from a site that had notes, I think. No, actually, this might be because... I can't say for sure. I would have to see which site it was taken from. It's most likely taken from Machon Mamre, which is a site that has the Hebrew and English of the Tanakh, and I now I'm not remembering what their system is. Okay. So now we're ready to jump into the Gemara. And so we're going to go, into the Mishnah at least. We're going to see where we get today. And we're also going to turn to another source or two before we leave the Mishnah, because we're going to ask ourselves, what conscious choice is being made here about what they included and what's not included? That we also know. But I'm going to ask you first, what do we know now if we're going to turn our attention to how to commemorate Yom Kippur? What do we need to do? Talk me through it. I got to get ready to afflict.
No work.
I got to get my white stuff clean.
Refrain from work.
Refrain from work. What else do I need to do?
Affliction, a way of afflicting your soul, is to fast.
Right.
A method.
So we're going to now fast. We're getting a lot of it.
We still have sex.
we really didn't see anywhere that talked about the sex part. What
is abstaining from other pleasures?
Other pleasures, that's right. That was the expansive idiomatic insertion. What else though do we need to do to get set for the day? And what was mentioned at the end part? I just want to note that there was one part in the Torah that I also kind of am wondering about still. On the ninth of the month in the evening, from evening to evening, you shall rest on your rest day. What's this ninth of the month piece? Because what day is Yom Kippur? So I just get one quick mention of the ninth. What do I got to do on the ninth if I really am going to commemorate? I got to get ready. What do I have to do to be ready for Yom Kippur? What?
You have to eat.
So there's one more element in here that I might have expected something about if I was opening up my Gemara, I was opening up my Talmud. I might have expected that. How do I know that the rabbis like to deal with what happens the day before a holiday? Right? Those of you who learned with me, we learned together last time. What did we learn? What was the name of the perek? Arve Pesachim, the day before Passover starts. Remember what the whole discussion at the beginning of the Mishnah over there was? What's happening the day before, the night before, the afternoon? What am I allowed to eat? What am I not allowed to eat? How close to it can it be? What point at Mincha do I stop? This and that. I might have expected some discussion. What's that?
About what to do.
But I don't get it. I can't answer exactly why yet. The Gemara might figure I know a little something from Masechet Brachot, which I'm going to show you after we study our Mishnah. Because there's one place in the Gemara that we do relate to the day before. And I'm also going to tell you that tradition of the day before has been expanded through the ages by halachists, who are rationalists, and by Hasidim and mystics, who see that day as important as the day of Yom Kippur. Really an interesting piece of tradition. But I want to go directly now, after the whole avoda, the work of the temple was done, Ayin Gimel Amud Bet. So you have the temple, and you have even right up to the last point, just to put it in the context, the discussion over here, right before our Mishnah, is, okay, Moses is passing the banner to who? He's passing the baton to Joshua. Joshua is going to become the leader. And vis-a-vis the Kohanim, who has the power to read the Urim and Tumim? Who has the power to make the read of the stones? And all this temple kind of reality is in focus, and then boom, the chapter ends. And just like there was a passing of one generation to the other, this is my understanding of narrative and how the end of the last chapter worked and the beginning of ours worked. There was a passing of the baton. So, too, is there a passing of all of that which was at the temple and all those temple rites and rituals to the time that we live in the time that will be, Chukat Olam for us, the forevermore statutes of how to live Yom Kippur among the Jews, B'kol Moshvotechem, in all of their dwelling places. And this is the beginning. And here you have it, and you were exactly right. We know the things that we need to do. So look at the Mishnah now with me. You can either follow 73b4 or inside on the page. We're in the first Mishnah of chapter 8. Yom HaKippurim Asur Ba'achila V'shtiya V'rechitza Uvasicha Uvanilana Sandal Uvatashmish Hamita. Nikuda. Period. On Yom Kippur, it is Asur. It is forbidden. What's the opposite of Asur?
Mutar.
So that's going to be two ends of a spectrum consistently within rabbinic legal discussion. Is it Asur or is it Mutar? Right? Those words come in. What word was not chosen here that could have been chosen? First of all, we don't see la'anot et nafshotechem. We don't see the expression you shall afflict your souls, you shall afflict your bodies. It's here, simply said, it's asur. These are forbidden. Perhaps because it doesn't want to get into a whole splicing of Torah words. Perhaps for a different reason. What's another word that could have been here? If I'm thinking about the Mishnah and apodictic law, codific law of the Mishnah, what other word besides asur might the Mishnah have used to tell me that I did something wrong, I'm guilty, and I need to do something about it? Chayav. It was a chet, and I'm chayav. It was a sin, and I'm obligated. What does the word chayav connote? That I'm obligated to bring an offering to the temple for this sin. The rabbis still utilize that system in action when people sin, despite the fact that the temple is destroyed, and despite the fact that it's, you know, latest news, we're building the diaspora forward, and we're not sending Bar Kokhba to fight the fight and rebuild the temple, or any of the troops that still have the spirit.
On Yom Kippur, the offering is a community offering or is an individual offering?
Well, we have the Kohen Gadol making one offering and for himself, and then we have, right, another one for the community. It's asur ba'achila, you can't eat, shtiyah, you can't drink. Is that one phrase or two? Ba'achila v'shtiyah, meaning all, right, what do we call, you know, the gastronomic activity phrase. Does that cover it all? Achila v'shtiyah? Is it you know, one or is it eating and drinking as two separate kind of things? This will be important to think about. Uvrechitza, and you can't wash yourself. Uvesicha, that's anointing one's body with oil. Uveni'ilata sandal, you can't wear shoes. V'tashmishamita, and you have no cohabitation, no sexual relationship. There it all is. Rashi. Yom HaKippurim Asur Ba'achila V'shtiyah. What does Rashi say, the first thing? So Rashi is always on the inside gutter of a page in the Hebrew. Not the very most inside, because the very most inside has a couple of what are called different kalim, different tools. But Rashi is kind of the block of text where you see a break in the middle with four big words in Hebrew print, Hadran Alach Balo. And then Yom HaKippurim. Yom HaKippurim Asur Ba'achila V'shtiyah Mefarish B'Gemara Dechol HaNi'ikri Inui. Ah, Rashi is the one who brings us back the language of Inui. Wants us to make sure we know we're connected to that language of the Torah. V'gabe Yom HaKippurim Hey Inuyim. There are five afflictions. So let's count them now. Go back to the Mishnah. Achila, shtia, rechitza, sicha, nilat ha-sandal,
the Tashmish Hamitzah.
Achila
v'shtiyah is one. Ah, so to Rashi, here's how we have to count. Achila v'shtiyah, rechitza, sicha, ni'ilat sandal, and tashmish hamita.
So he's got eating and drinking together is one.
At least the Gemara is going to tell us later. Oh, no, but he says here, v'hane hamesh havud z'shtiyah b'chlal achila. Because shtiyah, drinking, is included with achila. Now, would everybody agree off the bat? Just let me ask you: is drinking really included in?
No, I think they're two different.
Doctor. Can I survive longer? Like, what afflicts me more? And how does that work? Is achila and shtiyah the same thing?
No, drinking
for the body.
If you stop, you'll dry a lot faster with not drinking than not eating.
I'm saying,
if you die, you'll die a lot faster if you stop drinking than if you stop eating.
Oh, really? So you have less time if you stop drinking.
Because
we've all, thank God, overeaten.
The temperature and your exercise,
and I would last longer than most.
You'll loss of things that make you lose more water or less water, but clearly water is paramount. But most people will have enough fat so that they won't die if they stop eating for a period of time. That's why a lot of, we know from people in prisons who go on hunger strikes that they usually keep drinking, because if they stop drinking, it wouldn't be a very long hunger strike.
Uh-huh. Interesting. It seems to me that they're not the same. I mean, on a halachic premise, even if I didn't know the medical information, people just need a sip to get rid of the parched throat or the...
conceptually, though, Rashi sees this as
something passing your lips.
One category of passing through the lips, and then another category. So
no, I think that's what Rashi is bringing you, basically what the Gemara is going to argue over here. When we get to page 76, and there's going to be a place where kind of talks about how many you're really only allowed to have, because there's only so many mentions of the term. And by the way, we're going to see that that's actually an argument between the Bavli and the Yerushalmi as to how many I am allowed to count. So it's going to lead us to a discussion. Now, what's the difference between whether or not I've got five or six, one might say? We who learn Gemara know that there is a world of difference between five and six. And we know how incredible it is to hold five, like the books of the Torah, or six, like the number of seders in the Mishnah. I mean, we know that each of these numbers has such power. And that's why we're interested, because they have power.
I'm just wondering, we know, like, sociologically, what affliction might mean to contemporaneous groups. In other words, we're describing affliction here, but were there tribes or other cults where affliction to them meant starvation?
So that's why, actually, like, so we'll get, I won't get into it entirely right now, but we will a little bit down the line. When it comes to torture or suffering, we're going to see that other cultures had really other practices when it comes to torturing and suffering religiously. And we're thankful, I think, all of us, that we didn't go those directions. That we don't have that as part of our culture. So yes, we're gonna see that by way of religious culture of ancient times and up to the rabbinic times, that we could have gone a very different direction if you really were trying to get at suffering or self-flagellation.
So these five could be keeping it from becoming very zealous.
No doubt.
And these are kind of much milder, even though they're afflictions, they're not, drawing blood.
Yeah, and on top of that, the next line of the Mishnah is going to show us that there's some real rahmanis and room for the rabbis to tell you on Yom Kippur, don't worry, we're going to cover you. But
I just say that you're still God's creation, and if you do something that harms it, we know you're not allowed to do that.
Yeah.
So the borderline between affliction for penitence and harming God's creation has got to be one that's very careful.
And I think that is the conception coming through already in the first Mishnah of the Parak. I really do. I think they're talking about a very, very merachem God, a God of compassion, yet who needs you to be initem et nashotechem, who needs you to afflict your soul. And where do I as a human being, as an individual, a ben Elohim, a bat Elohim, a child of God, where do I see the place of having a little sense of suffering, affliction, whatever level that's going to be teased out to represent, and total compassion and indulgence in the gifts and pleasures of this world, where we also hold very, we hold dear the engagement with this world celebration. Right? So come to the great banquet of Slicha. Come to the great banquet of being pardoned of sins. We could have very well seen, based on some other Yom Kippur Shabbos type of banquet culture that we've created to make religious wonderful banquets and celebrations of godliness, we might have thought that could have been the way to go. You know, it didn't say exactly in Torah exactly what we do. But let's see what it says. Because not everyone has the same exact expectations. Here we're going to get a list of people who have a little bit of a different requirement. So it says, "V'amelech v'hakala yirchatzu et peneihem." The king and the bride should wash their faces. Okay. So Rashi again, Melech. If you're following me in the Rashi, you notice that he has a different script. We've said this before. The Rashi script is not Rashi's handwriting. It was the printers who wanted to offset the Perush, the commentary, of both Rashi, Rabbi Shlomo ben Yitzchaki, and Radak, Rabbi David Kinsky, when they printed the first Bibles. The Melech, Darko v'shivcho lehiyot na'e. You know, it's not good for the king to be dirty. You know, I won't quote Monty Python in the Holy Grail, but I'll remind you of the scene when he walks through the filth and they're yelling for folks to bring out their dead, and one says to the other, "Well, how do you know he's the king? He hasn't got beep all over him." Right? That's how they know he's the king. So that's exactly it. Melech has to, the king has to be kept clean. And v'hakala, and the bride, what about her? Why does she wash? Tzricha noi ad she techabev al bala. She has to look pretty. She has to look beautiful for her new chasen. V'chol shloshim yom lechupata. If they got married during the month of Elul, from the 10th forward of Elul, the month before Tishrei, within 30 days, she's allowed as a kala to wash. So what's interesting here, though, is how seriously they're taking the development of family life and married life, and that on a Yom Kippur, the first Yom Kippur, so if you wanted to have a wedding on the 11th of Elul so that you could wash on the next Yom Kippur to come and make it a special time for you as bride to be a little bit gussied up, whatever you want to call it, you might say, look, we got married this year. Can you imagine that they scheduled weddings that time? So that someone could walk into the great gathering of people for Yom Kippur in a little bit of a different appearance? I could see it. As soon as I reread it, I was saying to myself, oh, that's very interesting. Because, you know, brides and grooms, like, when they walk in, it's nice. It's nice to be called a bride and groom again once you've left your chuppah. just have that recognition in some different ways.
Well, it's nice for a bride to be on an equal footing with the king.
Right, isn't that nice?
I mean, you know, well, they call her a queen, you know, she's a queen, but it's very nice to have those very receptions.
Yeah. Okay.
So everything should be done for the bride.
Exactly. Okay, and what do we say about the v'chaya? Another person. V'chaya and the new mother, the one who gave birth, tin ol et hasandal. She should wear shoes. So why? That the cold floor is going to be difficult for her. They're worried on a couple of it could be a couple of different levels. That one, she stay warm and that her milk production, actually, we do everything we can to make her comfortable so that she, as a nursing mother, can have the right environment and the right sense of comfort so that she can do that. And also, she's not getting much sleep.
Is she allowed to eat?
It didn't say she's allowed to eat. Didn't say that. Now, again, did somebody on the editorial board say that a nursing mother might be able to drink? Interesting to think about those discussions again, right? As we think about the formation of the text in front of us and the kind of conversations that the Chachamim had, I really wonder whether or not there were some other discussions around that. Like, why this one and not that one? Because I do think that there's room. If we were going further into the Rishonim, we could talk about some of the other halachas and the halachic particulars that come out of this, but I didn't want to necessarily get us into those texts tonight. Maybe in time to come. Those come from just Kalim on the table. This is what's called the Mativta Gemara, and it has a compendium of discussions in halachic sources that grow out of the Gemara.
How far out in time does Chaya go? Their notion of it, saying someone has given birth recently, their sense of that.
Well, you probably say also, because the Kala is 30 days, you might say 30 days for the Yoledet. There are some people who discuss it and they say it's longer. Does it depend on the kid and whether the kid is colicky? I don't know.
Do they use whether the child is still being breastfed?
No, it's mostly the new mother. Obviously we know that breastfeeding happens much longer.
Yeah.
But this is, I think, for the initial kind of realities. Right.
She had to drink a lot.
Okay, so all of these exceptions and distinctions, Divrei Rabbi Eliezer, are Rabbi Eliezer's position. The Chachamim Osrim, but the sages forbid them. And we have to ask the question, like those who've made commentaries on the Mishnah, is the disagreement about all three, the Melech and the Kala, in relationship to washing their faces, and the Chaya, the new mother, in relation to the sandals, or are the words of Rabbi Eliezer about the new mother the only words being argued by the Chachamim? We're not really sure. It comes after comes after kind of both these two for that one, and this one with permission to do this. And thusly, there's some discussion as to whether or not there's agreement or disagreement about all three, the king, the bride, and the new mother, or just one of them.
According to note 9 here, it's just the three, the king, the queen, and the mother.
It's according to your note 9, what?
Note 9, yeah.
I did not get to that one. So, yeah, so that's basically the question. Okay. So, to push on through our Mishnah. Oh, by the way, anybody expect anything else by way of the Inui Nefesh that we know from what we do that maybe
somebody who's ill. Don't you think somebody who's
Yeah, so maybe somebody who's ill needed to be included on the list. So we don't see that person.
But pikuach nefesh is always, they don't need to mention it, because pikuach nefesh is 24 hours, 365 days. It doesn't need a specific.
Okay, so you're going to expand the ruling that saving a life, even zochet ha-shabbat, kind of supersedes Sabbath rules. You know, here we have Shabbat Shabbaton, and we could say, well, maybe Shabbat Shabbaton is different.
So they would let people die?
I don't think Bobby was referring to somebody who's on the verge of death.
Right, we're not talking about, maybe we're not talking about someone who's really on Shabbat.
Yeah.
The smallest holy, the smallest sickness, I'm allowed to put on a pot of chicken soup for you and cook. Yom Kippur, I'm going to do the same. Maybe I could give you a little drink. Maybe, so maybe there was some distinction to make about the level of sickness and
I'll tell you, in Israel, on Yom Kippur, Magen David Adom is full scale on...
Of course. So we treat everybody very, very carefully, but it could have said in the Mishnah is the point. We didn't see that category of person. We might have expected it.
And the only cars you see in Israel on Yom Kippur are the ambulance.
That's true.
They are working overtime.
And people on rollerblades, I saw the last time I was there. They love it. The street was theirs. It was unbelievable.
What else would people in wheelchairs see on there?
All right. I don't think so much of anything, but if you come up with something, let's keep pushing in the Mishnah. Ha'ochel kechotevet hagasa, if you eat the equivalent, the weight of one date, one large date, chmoa uchagarinata, the equivalent of that date and its pit inside. In other words, you put the date with the pit on the scale, that's your measure for how much you're allowed to eat on that's the threshold. Vashote malo lugmav, or drinks a quantity that's like a quantity that would fill up your cheeks. Chayav. You are chayav. And here we have your chayav, not asur, it's not just forbidden. But if you eat that, or drink that, you're cut off from your people. Karet. You're cut off entirely.
Less than olive. So you can eat all day long.
No, but that's really... Wait. You're mixing olives and dates. You're mixing olives and dates. We generally say about items that are asur la'achida, forbidden for eating, that if we eat less than an olive's bulk, could be okay. Now, there could be an argument about whether or not mid-araita or mid-rabbanon it's asur, whether it's a Torah prohibition or it's a rabbinic prohibition, and how severe one has to take eating of less than an olive's bulk. But an olive's bulk is generally the threshold for your chiyuv, your obligation to bring a sin offering if you've eaten them. Over here, the measure is very different. Over here, the measure is a date's bulk. And what will come into play in the first sugya that we're going to learn in the Talmud is what happens if you eat half a date's bulk?
Yeah.
The olive bulk size is not brought to bear. Again, for those of us who learn Talmud, we like distinctions like this. Why? We assume a date is bigger. And what are the rabbis concerned about? Potentially, that you're going to be overcome with such a hunger that you got to have at least a bite of something. Half an olive bulk, like this, you don't.
But you can have it as many times as you want.
No.
Because every time it's less than half.
I see you read like the book that they published in Israel, like, here's the trick for how to actually do
a
little bit of We're not talking about those kinds of fixes.
But so is this saying you can eat
something? The implied in this,
yeah,
implied in this, in the first Mishnah of how we do Yom Kippur is that if you eat the equivalent of the large day, meaning there's a threshold amount, then you're chayav.
But if you eat less,
but what happens if you eat less? It didn't tell you exactly what happens if you eat less. I want to read the Mishnah for what the Mishnah says. But that's the surprising piece. Now, is that for when someone has met a threshold status and I have to know what to feed them and how to feed them? For instance, and this was amazing, someone came to me, second year I'm here at the shul, and they were ill, but they really wanted to fast. But the doctor said, you really should eat something. So we worked out through looking at halachic sources, as Ron was saying in a funny way, this was real, that the person was going to eat less than a date's bulk a couple of times throughout the day. And by eating less than a date's bulk and adding them up for a person who didn't have the status as chole, you're in trouble. Because in general it's implied that you can only eat up to that much, a little less than, before you're really chayav karet. You're obligated and you're going to be cut off. But for a chole, for someone who's ill, different story. And it's pretty cool how it all works out. There's actually a kiddush for Yom Kippur. But getting back to the Mishnah, it simply says, doesn't even present the case. One who eats up to a large date in its pit, and one who drinks the fill of their cheeks, then you're chayav. Before that, the implication is you're not. Kol ha'ochlim mitarfim lechochal tevet. And remember, all that you will eat, you know, it's not like you can eat up to 98% of the date's bulk 10 times. Everything you're eating has to be taken as to be included in the little scale if you were going to be measuring it out. The chol ha'mashkin mitzalfin limlo lugvav, and all of the liquid that you're drinking also has to add up to the right amount. Can't pass the threshold amount. Ha'ochel v'shote ein mitzalfin though, but eating and drinking don't combine. Ah, so if you want to eat 98% of the day's bulk and you want to drink 98% of the full cheeks measure, then, okay, at this point, you're not cut off at least. Is it a sore?
Yes.
It's a sore! Where do we learn it's a sore? Top of the Mishnah. It's a sore. Forbidden. But you're not chayav. The point of the Mishnah is to differentiate the way we understand halacha because of the deep humanity built within the halachic system is going to be the way that I'll present so much of what happens within Yom Kippur. The way that we are seen as God's children, and yet we are to make inui nefesh. We are to have some sense of affliction and some sense of whatever this word affliction is going to mean, and we're going to keep parsing out what does it really mean to have this experience of inui nefesh. And so that's a wonderful combination of details that, by the way, doesn't appear in the Mishnah in the Yerushalmi. Not yet. The discussion doesn't happen yet. It gives a halacha and then has a discussion without all the nuance that we usually get in our printed versions of this Babylonian Talmud. And thusly presents in a very different way.
So how did the Chachamim knew the measure, the way God measure where he's going to inflict a punishment of karet? Where did they take it from?
They had Ruach HaKodesh. They had understanding from
it. Isn't it in the Bible somewhere that they
They had a sense that they needed to run, give you the categorical definitions.
No, I understand that they established
they,
it,
in Kritut,
is there any...
In Mishnah Kritut, they have 36 different... sins that require karet, you know, cut off. They believe deeply that they are explaining to you the Torah's meaning when it said you're going to be cut off from your people. This is what's going to do it. And they're dealing with that discussion right here, right in front of our eyes. that's what they did. Let's look at the Yerushalmi just as a comparison. We're into our book, and I try to do handouts for all the other pieces we look at. We're gonna come back to the Yerushalmi. So if you have a Gemara, keep the Yerushalmi tucked into your Gemara. Now, what you have to remember about this version of the Gemara, the Oz V'Hadar version, the Yerushalmi is presented in two different ways. We don't have the second way on the shelf yet. One day we'll buy the second way that the Yerushalmi is presented. The classic way of the Yerushalmi is to present all of the text of the Yerushalmi as four columns. When you open the book, it will just have one, two, three, four. It doesn't look like what we consider to be the Talmudic page, which is, again, a whole development of the history of the Talmudic page and how it got that way. But because that became so popular, this Yerushalmi is presented in that format so that we can see it, and it looks like the Bavli to us. And that, the text is still presented in the same way, but, I mean, it says the same thing, but it's presented in different ways, visually. Anyway, chapter 8, Halacha 1, where is it going to end? It's going to end with the Chachamim Osrim, with the sages prohibited. Right? So it's going to start. Yom HaKippur, Yom HaKippur, Asur, it's prohibited to what? See if they're the same. Ba'achila, and eating. Uvashtiyah, drinking. Uvarichitzah, and washing oneself. Uvasicha, and anointing one's body. Uva ne'ilat sandal, and wearing shoes. Uva tashmish mita, and cohabitation. Right? We're good. Says the same thing. Hamelech v'akala yirchatzu epneihem. King and a bride may wash their faces. V'achaya tin ole et sandal, and a new mother may wear shoes. Divrei Rabbi Eliezer. These are the words of Rabbi Eliezer. V'chachamim osrin. Right? It's the same because the mission is the same. What's going to be different is right after the beginning presentation of the Gemara, over here, you're going to get a braita, which we don't have time for tonight, that tells you the source of the prohibitions against eating and drinking on Yom Kippur. So next time, we're going to start over here, and we're going to go back to our Gemara in the Babylonian Talmud, and we're going to see what the first discussion is over there. Because it's a little different. Not that you won't get to the sources, but it's a little different. And so the narrative is a little different. And we're going to ask, what's with the narrative being different? So tuck that into your Gemaras, and we'll come back to that. Or you can, of course, give it back to me, and I'll have it here for you for the next time. And I want to end with this last piece. So what about the day before? Since I got right into it, and since we know now not to eat, not to drink, not to anoint, not to have sex, not to do these things, what about day 9? Maybe the sages remembered what we remember from Gemara Masechet Brachot, page 8b, where there's the discussion about what's to be on the 9th of Tishrei. Second paragraph down. Rabbi Bevai bar Abaye Savar la'ashluminhu lefarashayata dechola. He wanted to finish all of the Torah portions of the entire year. Shat b'mala yoma. It was on the eve of Yom Kippur. Okay, b'mala yoma de Kippure. It was on the eve of Yom Kippur. Right, so he wants to finish reading all the Torah. Tanale Chia bar Rav Medifti, and Rav Chia bar the son of Rav Difti taught him Ketiv
V'initim et nafshatechem b'tisha v'chodesh be'erev. And you shall afflict your soul on the ninth day of the month of the evening. Right? No, we didn't kind of get into really parsing that last part of the Levitical section. What does it mean, the ninth day? I thought we were talking about the tenth day. Right? So I'm supposed to, wait, do an inui on the ninth? As the Gemara says, v'chi b'tisha mit'anin. But do we fast on the ninth? I thought we fast on the tenth. And we said, how do we do Yom Kippur? We fast. But when do we fast? We fast on the tenth. V'halo ba'asara mitanin. We fast on the tenth. Eila lamar lecha. Here's what it's really saying, though. That passage in Leviticus, and this story comes to be the agadic story that's going to help us learn halacha. Right? Sometimes a tale of a sage helps us then codify the Jewish law we need. Kol ha'ochel b'shoteh b'tishei, anyone who eats and drinks on the ninth, ma'ale alav ha'katuv ke'ilu mitanei tishei v'asiri, we ascribe to him, having fulfilled the verse, you shall afflict your soul, yourself, on the ninth and the tenth. What do we just do to affliction of the soul then? It not only includes fasting. What does it also include?
Eating.
Eating! It's so Jewish. Only the Jews could say, here's how you really fast. You eat, and you don't eat. The eating part we're calling a fast, too. And the ninth and the tenth have become the days of Yom Kippur, so forever in your lives now, you're going to get up in the Beit Midrash, and you're going to have a two-day Yom Kippur now. You're going to prepare so deeply for that Sudat Masechet that it's going to be part of the Inui Nefesh. And so, with suffering, torture? No. With affliction? Yeah. Maybe it's going to afflict me so much because I ate such a great meal beforehand. I'm remembering every bit of what I ate. But maybe in the affliction, there's also the sense of humbling myself, meaning I could have a banquet one day and be nothing the next.
Chances are you're over 8 on the ninth.
That's right.
And you're afflicted from the
ovaries. That's right. You're probably, and if they don't pass around holy tongues.
So
I wonder whether your fasting isn't harder after you've eaten a lot. I bet that if you eat lightly the day before, it might be easier to fast. I mean, they may have known some kind of connection between eating a lot and then...
Here's how I'll answer, Bobby. People tell me, forget your caffeine, go off it 3-4 days, do one cup and then one half cup and then no cup.
Yeah.
You know what I do? I drink coffee right up to the minute.
Well, it must work because you have great...
I drink coffee right up
to
the... Oh, it works. It works. And so too with eating. I find it to be that if I have a great meal and we've kind of perfected the menu, I have like an unbelievable fast that I'm so satisfied from what I ate before. I don't know. That's me. But everyone, now you have an expanded version of Inui, and it's wonderful to start the Talmud class again with you and start our learning together. Really lovely to see people back, see people anew, and excited for this Masechta. It's a great Masechta. Yeah, Carol.
Okay, so you're not supposed to work, so I need to work.
That's right.
Okay, but rabbis are working.
that's a whole big irony of the Jewish world. That's right. It's like the Kohanim who had to do their work. You know what they say, though, about paying rabbis? You're only giving them what they could have made in the marketplace if they went to have a real job.
So speaking of Kohanim, I happen to be out of town for the night, so I was down in Florida. I went to the Chabad.
He spoke. Wow.
So, yeah.
I imagine.
Really?
I imagine.
Don't look at the Kohanim. Right.
Be very careful.
Oh my God.
Very careful.